Let us hear God's word as we turn to the book of Daniel. Book of Daniel, and we read together Daniel chapter 6. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We will never find any basis for charges against this man, Daniel, unless it has something to do with the law of his God." So the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, "O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room with the windows open towards Jerusalem. 3 times a day he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except to you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the decree you put in writing. He still prays 3 times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to the king and said to him, "Remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order. They brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king signed it, sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles, so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. And the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. When he came near the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" Daniel answered, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king." The king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found in him, because he had trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. Before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is a living God. He endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Could we imagine a politician today investigated in the closest possible detail, all of his actions, all of his affairs coming under scrutiny and passing that test? No one able to find anything against him. It's hardly conceivable in the political world of our day. We're so familiar with the corruption that characterizes many in public life, even if it's not on a grand scale. There are the dark areas that politicians would prefer the press and others not to probe. But Daniel was a man who passed the test. The most hostile investigation imaginable, and yet no charge could be brought legitimately against Daniel. He's a man worth considering. As Christians, we increasingly find ourselves out of step with society around us. Isn't that the case? Don't you find that your values, your attitudes, your whole way of life increasingly is at odds with people around you? The things that we value, others set no store by. The standards of conduct that we seek to meet are of no interest to people around us. The days of outward respect and conformity to Christian standards, by and large, are past. And people have been living on the capital from a Christian past that now is largely dissipated. We live in a society that we no longer expect to share our view of life, and perhaps we're naive if we do expect it. Different values, different attitudes, different lifestyles. None of them compatible with the standards of God's word. And the gap is increasing rapidly. Those of you who are younger will find more and more that your whole way of life is out of sync with the world around you. And it will be costly to follow Christ. It will be increasingly difficult to live consistent, godly lives in our society. The kind of changes that are going on in the world around us actually bring the world of the Bible closer to us, because we read in Scripture of God's people by and large living in a hostile environment. And that was true in Daniel's day in a very striking and a very stark way. He lived in a pagan society. He was raised to the highest levels of a government that had no regard for the God of Israel. And yet Daniel was able to live consistently in such an environment. Often it must have been very, very difficult. We can draw encouragement from the account of Daniel in Babylon. And I want this evening particularly to focus on Daniel chapter 6. Here we think of Daniel in this hostile environment, and yet experiencing the grace and the mercy of God. I want to think of Daniel 6 in the teeth of the enemy. In the teeth of the enemy. Here we will find not just a nice little story for children. And so often Daniel 6 is reduced almost to that level. But here we see profound spiritual principles that we all, as Christian adults, need to take to heart and by God's grace put into practice in the teeth of the enemy. Because that is where we all find ourselves, spiritually speaking. As we look at Daniel 6, we see first of all the trap set. The trap set. First, we see a godly man. And that, from the very outset, is the impression that Daniel conveys. It's interesting, when you look at the sequence of events in the book of Daniel, by this stage, Daniel is actually a man of about 80. And in the world of that day, that is a very old man. In our society, things have changed. But Daniel, in the world of his day, was an old man. We might say he could have been excused for taking things a bit easier by that stage in life. But we see the same godly character in Daniel at 80, as we saw in Daniel the young man, if you turn back to chapter 1. The same consistency, the same strength of godliness, the willingness to stand in the face of opposition. He did it as a young man, and now many years later, he's doing exactly the same thing. And of course, there were special challenges in the position he occupied in government. All kinds of pressures that the ordinary person would never even be aware of, much less experience. And yet we're told in verse 3, he so distinguished himself that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Here is Daniel at almost dizzying heights of influence here in the Medo-Persian Empire, the great power of the day. And what was the secret of Daniel's success? If Daniel was to write one of those self-help manuals that are so popular, The Secret of My Success, or some other version of it, what would it be? And we're told, as one of the translations puts it in verse 3, an excellent spirit was in him. The NIV has his exceptional qualities, but an excellent spirit was in him. Here's evidence of the grace of God. That is what made Daniel what he was. It was a supernatural work, the presence of the Holy Spirit in the heart and life of Daniel here at the center of pagan power in Persia. An excellent spirit, the result of God's grace. And flowing from that was the fact that even in what we think of as worldly affairs, politics, the dirty business of government, Daniel is a man of unassailable integrity. And his enemies did their level best to uncover something discreditable to him. And yet in verse 4 we are told all their efforts came to nothing. They were unable to find anything that would stand up as a charge against Daniel. Amazing integrity in the most unpromising circumstances. And we are reminded that the grace of God equips his people for whatever work he assigns us. It is not just for ministry or mission work, but for whatever God's calling may be in society. As a homemaker, as a professional, as a worker in some other area of life. God's grace equips, gives whatever is necessary. It was so for Daniel in politics. And it's so for all of his people in their different callings and their different situations. God equips his servants. So here is Daniel, a godly man. And not in a setting where it was easy to be godly and where there was plenty of fellowship and support. But in a situation where we might say all the odds were stacked against him. And yet we see his integrity shining brightly. A godly man. But on the other side we see equally clearly ungodly enemies. And here is the reality of politics as we know it in our own world. The other senior officials in Persia are stirred to jealousy. Here is Daniel, this incomer, even after all the years he served in the empire. He's a foreigner. He's different. He's Jewish. And he's getting on way too fast for the liking of his colleagues. And they tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel, we're told in verse 4. They're motivated, first and foremost, of course, by jealousy. They cannot abide the fact that Daniel is getting on, and before long he's going to be set over them all. Not just one of the top three, he's going to be next to the emperor himself. But such is Daniel's integrity, as we've said, that his work is irreproachable. And that is quite an achievement in any political environment. There is no misbehavior. There is nothing that enemies can fasten onto to discredit him or spin against him. So what are they going to do? Well, they're astute enough to know that the only way they're going to be able to discredit Daniel is to use his religion. Something to do with the law of his God, they decide in verse 5. And they're exactly right, of course. They're going to bring religion into it. Of course, we're told on all sides, religion and politics don't mix. And when they don't, we see the results of it in our own public life. But they'll use religion in Daniel's case. And that's another element in their hostility. There is professional jealousy. But the kind of violent hostility that is driving these men is rooted in something deeper. It's rooted, finally, in a hatred of Daniel as a man of God. Religion is not just a pretext for getting rid of Daniel. It's at the root of why they resent him so much and want to destroy him. The spiritual difference between Daniel, the man of God, and all of these enemies ranged against him. The spiritual difference makes their hatred, their loathing of Daniel all the deeper and all the more bitter. And don't we see that often in life? That there may be differences on various grounds, professional or whatever. But if you bring religion into the matter, then there comes often a bitterness of opposition that shows the depth of hatred, not just of a man of God, but of the God that Daniel served. And that's really the deepest issue. These are enemies not simply of Daniel, but these are enemies of Daniel's God. And they reveal the state of their heart. They show their spiritual condition by the way they treat this servant of God. Daniel's life was indeed according to the law of his God. There's a consistency in Daniel as he lives his life according to the scriptures that he had. He delights in the law of God, like the psalmist in Psalm 1. It's not a burden to keep God's law. And Daniel had been tested many times, no doubt many times that aren't recorded in the Bible. We have a few listed, but there must have been many year in, year out, serving godless rulers with all the pressures that that would bring. And he lives according to the law of his God. And that set him apart. It's inevitable. And so it is for anyone who lives their life according to the law of God. Anyone who seeks consistent godliness. It sets us apart, and that will be costly. Doesn't Jesus warn us in John 15:19, I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. Whatever the reasons on the surface for opposition to Christians, at its root, it is spiritual. It is evidence of the state of the heart. And Daniel's experience is just one example of the spiritual warfare into which all of God's people are called. If you are a Christian, you are in the battle. The Lord is not asking you to volunteer. You're already there at the front. And you're in the midst of the battle. Daniel knew what that meant in his particular setting and circumstances. And each of us in our different settings will know the reality of the spiritual battle. The enemy will be very interested in us. sometimes Christian standards are respected by the world, but often and increasingly, they will provoke hostility. The trap set. But secondly, we see the faithfulness of Daniel. The faithfulness of Daniel. All these officials come together. You see all the way through the chapter, they operate together. And they come to King Darius. And really they draw him into making a decree without his fully realizing what he's doing. On the face of it, it seems to us maybe ridiculous. A decree that for 30 days, nobody will pray to any god or man except Darius. And yet, in that pagan culture, it made a kind of sense. The pagans, for a month, would be happy enough to pray to someone else. Well, if it's the king, so be it. He's a son of the gods, probably, and we'll pray to him for a month and then go back to our own gods, back to Bel and Nebo and Marduk and all the others that they prayed to the rest of the time. Not a big problem to the pagan mindset. But of course, for a man of God like Daniel, obedience is utterly impossible. There is no point of compromise with a decree like that. Daniel cannot go part way to try and conform. This is black and white, if ever there was black and white. Obedience is impossible. And of course, the very first commandment in the summary of God's law is, "You shall have no other gods before me." Exodus 20 and verse 1. To pray to any being, any man or deity would be idolatry, covenant breaking, unfaithfulness to the Lord. For Daniel to discontinue prayer for 30 days would have been practical unbelief, betrayal of his Lord. And so we could go on describing it. From every perspective that Daniel possessed, this was unacceptable. He must pray to his God. He could not stop for 30 days, much less address prayer to any other object whatsoever. And the issue is clear for Daniel. It's summed up in the words of the apostles in Acts 5:29. We must obey God rather than men. There is no middle ground. There may be situations where God's people may go some way to satisfy the demands of government or others. But here's an issue where it is either obey God or obey man. And for the child of God, there really is no choice. It's a decision that ought to make itself. God's law must prevail. And Daniel, of course, was no fool. He would know the cost. He knew the realities of life in the Persian Empire. If you disobeyed the king, there would be inevitable consequences. But he must obey God rather than man. And so the account unfolds. Daniel continues his normal practice of prayer. He goes to his housetop, he opens the windows, he prays towards Jerusalem, verse 10. Jerusalem, it would symbolize the dwelling place of God, his homeland, the place where spiritually he belonged. And he sets his mind supremely on the Lord. He focuses on God and God's purposes. He prays for help, we're told. He prays for the grace of God in this desperate situation. But no doubt a man like Daniel wasn't only occupied with his own needs. He would be praying for the cause of God. Praying for the fulfillment of God's promises regarding the nations. We thought something of that this morning in Zechariah. Perhaps praying for God to bring the nations to Jerusalem in the language of Isaiah 2 and other of the prophets. There are some, I've heard it preached this way, that Daniel went out of his way on this occasion to publicize his prayer, that he went to the most public location where people would hear him. But there's no evidence in the passage that Daniel did anything different. He wasn't flaunting his prayer. He wasn't provoking trouble. He simply did what, as a man of God, he did every day. The same place, the same prayers, we're told, verse 10, praying, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Daniel doesn't change anything. He's not provoking martyrdom as on occasion Christians have done historically. He does what he's always done. The same consistent, godly practice of prayer. And he's not going to change it for anyone. Not for the king of the Persian Empire. Not for anyone. Daniel is strengthened for the time of trial by his discipline in prayer, in worship. This is part of the fabric of Daniel's life. It's not as if there's a sudden emergency and Daniel thinks, well, I haven't prayed for a while, I better do some praying now. Sometimes we're like that, sadly. The prayer's neglected until the pressure is on, and then suddenly we remember we ought to be praying. But Daniel was a consistent man of prayer. It's part of his life. It's the way he is. It's simply natural for Daniel in this crisis to go on praying the way he does every day. The subject of his prayers maybe will be different. But it's that daily discipline of prayer, spending time in the presence of God, that strengthens Daniel for the crisis that is coming upon him. An occasional practice is always easy to drop, isn't it? If you just do something now and again, it's true of any hobby, any activity, anything. If you just do it now and again, it's very easy to stop. Something that is a regular, consistent practice, a habit that's built into your life, it's easier to carry it on. And prayer is no exception. What is disciplined and regular part of your life will be there in the times of need. It'll give you strength when the crisis comes upon you. Daniel knew the reality of disciplined prayer. And we need that same discipline. It's so easy to let prayer slip. When we're busy, when there are pressures, when there are demands, what is the first thing to go? Well, if we're honest, all too often it's prayer. Oh, maybe a quick word as we dash out and we think we've prayed. But not really spending time before the Lord. Here's Daniel, almost the highest in the land, praying regularly. Here's his faithfulness to his God. And that's what's needed for the time of testing. If we're not people who are faithful to our God, then we are very, very vulnerable when the enemy attacks. Daniel's faithfulness. We've seen the trap set. We've seen Daniel's faithfulness. Now, thirdly, we think of the trap sprung. It all comes together. Here's that same disreputable band of satraps and prefects and administrators and all the rest of it. They seem to go around in a bunch. They go to the king, make the representations. They go looking for Daniel. He's not hard to find. They know where he is. They all go together, strength in numbers. Maybe nobody has the courage on their own, but they band together to do their dirty work. And they've been exploiting the king's weakness and his sinful pride. Probably Darius had been on the throne for a relatively short time. And so he is vulnerable in a way. He needed the support of these powerful figures in the kingdom. He couldn't afford to offend them. And that's one of the reasons for his weakness. And he doesn't foresee the consequences of his actions. He's not a chess player who's looking several moves ahead. He only sees what's right in front of him. But the chief appeal of the whole project surely is simply his pride. He's proud. And so they offer, "Anyone who prays to any god or man except to you, O king." And didn't they seem to be honouring him and giving him such wonderful respect? And you can almost sense them swelling with pride that they want to pray to him. How wonderful, how they respect him. And don't forget, he doesn't want to offend them and cause any problems. To be treated as a god. And it seems maybe ridiculous. You'll not be deceived by offers of prayer to you, I'm sure. But again, here is an ungodly, a pagan man, a product of his culture. And after all, what was the first temptation? Adam and Eve. "You will be like God." And our desires to be like God may not be as crass and as obvious as those of Darius, but they're there. The temptation to put ourselves in the place that God should have. And fundamentally, it's the same sin. We may not be asking for prayer, but so often we put ourselves where God should be, at the center of life. "You will be like God." And the heart of every sinner is vulnerable to that temptation. Here in Darius, there's the height of arrogance that leads him to act in a way that he will bitterly regret. And the conspirators know exactly what to do. They went as a group, or they went by agreement would be another way to translate it. They found Daniel praying, no surprise. They knew he'd be there. And they're not going to allow the king to back out. "Did you not say?" And you can imagine their attitude as they're there. They've got the king where they want him. He's cornered. The law of the Medes and Persians can't be changed. He signed the edict. It's done. For all his supposed power, the king actually is trapped as well in a different sense. He can't undo what he's done. And he's left in the position of condemning a godly man to death. Because that surely seemed certain. The king shows what appears to be genuine anguish. Verse 18. He knows he's done wrong. He knows he's been made a fool. And he does his best to try and get Daniel out of this. But there's no way. It's a reminder too that Satan can use the law to persecute the people of God just as easily as he can use lawlessness. You think of the condemnation of Jesus. John 19:7. "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die." All perfectly legal. The law was there, used by the devil. We need to be on our guard with reference to the laws of our own nation. There are laws that are making Christian witness more and more difficult. Where to speak the truth of God in different ways is becoming illegal. The devil himself can use the law to frustrate the gospel. The trap sprung. They have achieved their goal, they think. Here, finally, they're getting rid of Daniel. He'll be nothing but a heap of chewed bones in the morning. How they must have rejoiced. How the devil that drove them must have rejoiced as he rejoices over all the sufferings of the children of God. The trap sprung. But we don't end the account there, of course, because we see finally the faithfulness of God. The faithfulness of God. And in a real sense, that is what this whole passage is about. The focus isn't primarily on Daniel. It's on Daniel's God. And that becomes more and more clear as the account unfolds. An important principle regarding God's dealings with his people we find in 1 Samuel 2 and verse 30. Those who honour me, I will honour. Now that is not a promise of freedom from trouble. It's not a statement about how God will honour those who honour him. Sometimes he does it in surprising ways. But he does honour those who honour him. He does it in ways that will glorify his name, will advance his purpose of salvation. But he will honour them. We have that conviction. So it is with Daniel. God shows himself to be, according to verse 20, the living God. All the idols of Babylon are dead, lifeless. They're not gods at all. The God of Daniel is the living God. Daniel is his faithful servant. I was found innocent in his sight, says Daniel in verse 22. God intervenes in a miraculous way. He sends his angel. So much so, we are told, no wound was found on Daniel because he had trusted his God. That is not to say that Christians will never be martyred. We know that that isn't the case. We know that for many, death is the outcome of faithfulness to the Lord. The record of Daniel is not a promise that God will make sure his people are never killed. But God will honour them in his own way and his own time. You find exactly the same in the case of Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego back in chapter 3. They're facing the fiery furnace. And they say to Nebuchadnezzar, our God is able to save us. They were convinced of that. And then they go on, but if he doesn't, we still won't bow to your idol. They recognized it might be God's will that they should perish in the fiery furnace, but they would not be inconsistent or unfaithful. So with Daniel. Daniel had no guarantees when he was thrown into the lion's den that he would come out alive. But in this case, it was God's purpose that he would be preserved as a demonstration that his God is the living God and the God who is able to deliver his servants. God never abandons his faithful people. And that's the principle above all that we see in this passage. God is faithful to his faithful people. For Daniel, it meant escape from the lion's den. For some Christians, it means deliverance from danger and from persecution. For some, it may mean death. But God never abandons his faithful people. He honours their testimony. There have been those converted as a result of seeing Christians dying in the Lord as martyrs. And they were vindicated. And God was glorified. As Paul knew, whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord. That's the truth we have in Romans 14:8. Whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord. It was true of Daniel. It's true of every child of God. What God's purpose for individuals in particular circumstances, we can't predict. Some will be delivered, some will not. God has not failed those who are not delivered. His glory and his purposes are best served when they lay down their lives. Some Christians are set free from hardship and suffering. Others, all through their lives, must endure burdens. God has not failed those who must continue to endure. In his wisdom and his love, he decrees how best he will be glorified and how best they will be shaped in the likeness of his Son. God is a faithful God. The God of Daniel, the living God, never fails his children. And we in our day have that same confidence. We may never be called to face a life or death challenge as Daniel was. But each day is a spiritual battle. Each day we are faced by challenges and temptations. How will we respond to them? Will we listen to the siren voices of the enemies? Will we cave in to the pressures that the world will bring against us? Or by God's grace will we stand fast and remain faithful, whatever the cost, knowing that we belong to the Lord in every circumstance, in every situation, and God will never fail us? We can't do it in our own strength, that's certainly true. But by the grace and strength of God, we may stand fast as Daniel did. God's name will be glorified. Here's this pagan king moved to some acknowledgement of God at the end of the chapter. How much it signified, we don't know. But even a man like that was touched by what he saw and heard. How many will be touched by what they see and hear in us if we are faithful to our God in the hour of testing? May the Lord fill us by his Spirit and make us faithful people, faithful as Daniel was, in whatever circumstances he calls us to face, so that his name is glorified and his cause is advanced.